Hi, this is Robert O'Reilly. My name is Gowron. Honor to you and your house. You're listening to Trek FM.
T.O. Greyhawk.
And welcome to another episode of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to the next generation. I'm your host, Amy Nelson, and joined with me today is Richard Marquez.
Yay! Yay!
Now, while Richard and I were on a away mission, we found a replica of Lee's head. Lee is missing. So we have enlisted the help of Justin Ozer to solve this mystery. Justin, we're so glad to have you. Would you like to say hi to our listeners?
Hello, everyone. Very happy to be here. And I hope we do find out what happened to Lee's head so that in the future he can come on the show again. Yeah.
Yes, we do miss him, and so we will have him hopefully back next week. So today's episode is Time's Arrow, Part 1 and Part 2, and we had this suggestion by Justin, and we all agree that Time's Arrow is a good episode, a good set, and in the past, it's been maligned to not be so good, and so we're here to set the record straight about that. So, Richard, why don't you give us a quick synopsis and rundown of what Time's Arrow Part 1 and Part 2 is about, and then we'll get on to our discussion.
Absolutely. And I'll just read it off of Memory Alpha. An engineering team finds evidence of an alien presence on Earth in 19th century San Francisco. Data's head, severed head, buried 500 years ago. And this is the season finale for... is it season
five.
Four?
Three? Five.
Thank yeah. you. So see, this is the season finale for season five and the opening of season six. So awesome.
I'm so glad you guys like it.
It's a really good episode. I remember watching it as a kid, and it was one of those episodes that were very interesting to have, like, a Mark Twain twist to it, Mark Twain added into the actual, into the future or something like that. I mean, it's a really interesting, very interesting episode. I don't want to take too much of it, but I mean, obviously, you know, aliens going into the past to basically kill off people that are already dying, like maybe bubonic plague or polio or
cholera,
exactly. Or even smallpox. I mean, once they're dead, if they're going to harvest their body and they're already dead, then why not?
Well, I do have to say that they were very considerate to go in a time where there was an outbreak, where people were already dying. I guess we could give them the benefit of the doubt for that.
But yeah, it definitely, I definitely liked it as a kid. And, you know, it's I still like it now.
I really like it because it's memorable. I mean, you can, whether you like it or you hate it, if anyone says Next Generation Time's Arrow, you know exactly what episode it is. And for that, you've got to give it props.
What do people say when you hear about it? When they say, when they talk about the episode, what do they say about it?
Well, I'll tell you what I've heard. What I've heard is that they think Mark Twain is really annoying, and that even the cast members think he's annoying and keep shooting him glances that he should just shut up. But you know what? I love it. I think that the Mark Twain is charming, and I think it's actually true to his character if you read what he was writing, because he could be kind of a curmudgeon or, you know, really skeptical of certain things, really worried about the impact of technology. So I actually like that, and I find it to be a really charming character. And one of the things I like about the episode as well is that someone might correct me if I'm wrong about this on the Babel conference, but I think this is the only Star Trek episode where we actually go to the 19th century. It's not something on the holodeck like the Sherlock Holmes episodes. It's not like an alien illusion, like in the TOS episode Spectre of the Gun. It's not like a society that's based on the 19th century America, like in the Enterprise episode North Star. They're actually going there to the 19th century. And I find, I'm a bit of an American history buff, and I find the 19th century to be really fascinating because there are all of these important inventions that were happening. Electricity going to homes, the light bulb, sound recording, cars and phones and things like that. But at the same time, it was a time of great change. There was a lot of income inequality. There were still disease to be eradicated. So there are all of these things going on. You get certain references and hints to that in the episode. But I find it to be a pretty rich and fascinating time in American history. And I like that they go there and they're kind of really a part of that.
Yeah, going off that, one of the things that I really liked was Troy and Clemens' conversation when he was up on the Enterprise, and he was, you know, saying, oh, this future thing is terrible. You've got too much technology. Like you were saying that, you know, there are a lot of people who are suspicious about technology and what it's going to do. And he was saying, can't even open the door for a lady, you know, because these doors open automatically. And basically commenting that you're removing the basic human interaction with each other. And then we get our lovely Deanna Troi explaining the 24th century utopia society, as we've talked about previously, you know. And so she just sort of says, well, there has been poverty has been eradicated, and just what the 24th century and how blissful it is, and that there's no slavery, and that we have multiple species, thousands of species that we're interacting with. And so I like that, you know, she does sort of give a rundown of how it is in the 24th century. And then Clemens is like, well, maybe this is worth giving up cigars for, you know, that maybe it's not that bad, you know, and has that change of heart.
Yeah. I love that part because, I think, as I said in the Babel conference before, I love kind of the idealistic future that they're talking about, a better future for us to strive for. And you see this difference between what was going on in the 19th century and bringing someone from that period and seeing what it's like hundreds of years later. I just really like that aspect of it. And actually, like in that conversation, the Twain character has some really, you know, vivid ways of putting it. He talks about, you know, the wealthy standing on the backs of the poor and things like that. He just puts it in these stark terms. And they make a reference in the episode as well to A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, which is one of Twain's novels that was published a little before this, where somebody goes from the 19th century back into the Middle Ages in England, and they bring all of this technology and basically destroy the society, and there's an apocalyptic war that happens because of that. So his way of thinking is that technology could be extremely dangerous, and to see it being used for good purposes, I just love that part, and I think it's really interesting.
I just had a flashback of Time Cop. You know, you've never seen that movie, Amy?
No.
I don't think I have.
Oh, man. Okay.
But I could get the idea. Yeah. Is it like apocalyptic?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So just to give you a synopsis of that one, it's basically a cop going back in time trying to find this guy who's killing people with basically higher technology, or, you know, better, more advanced technology and whatnot. So, yeah. It's a very, it's a total recallish kind of movie.
Yeah, but that's also something that makes Twain really appropriate here, because that was one of the very first time travel novels, was Connecticut Yankee, which was in 1889. And he was very influential in kind of helping to launch all of that. And of course, time travel is so important in Star Trek. I don't know, so I guess getting back to the original point, I think a lot of people are annoyed by Twain, but I think it's charming, and I think the depiction is right on, and it actually adds a lot to the episode. And Jerry Hardin, who played Mark Twain, he enjoyed it so much that he actually did a one-man show on Mark Twain on and off for about 15 years.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, I think he did a great job of kind of channeling what you see in a lot of his writings.
Since we are talking about writers, I do like the bellboy, Jack. And then who ends up being Jack London. Oh, can follow your dreams and go off to Alaska. And then we get into
the wild.
Yeah.
Call the Wild.
Who hasn't read that book?
It's
I had to read
book.
It in middle school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite books as a child. I absolutely love that part. I mean, even though it was like a few seconds, but still, it was. I love that part.
Yeah. I know. It was really nice just to get that little reference. And it's like, oh, yeah, I do know Jack.
I find the Jack London character really charming as well. But, you know, so they're going back into this period and they have Twain and Jack London meet. And I was doing a little research. It turns out it's very, very unlikely that they ever met each other, or that Twain was even in San Francisco at the time because he was trying to pay off some debts in Europe. But for those kinds of things that seem like historical inaccuracies, I actually have an explanation for it that I've been thinking of. So,
ooh, do tell.
So the way that I think about it is that everything that happens in Star Trek is not actually happening in our timeline. So the one that, you know, you and I share and everybody who's going to be listening to this podcast, it's actually an alternate timeline that has a lot of similarities to our own. But there are differences in things that happen in different periods of history when they go back in time. So I think of it as something separate, and that helps me to explain other things like the eugenics wars and, you know, the Millennium Gate and Voyager that clearly doesn't exist. So I think of this all as taking place in something that's very similar, but actually separate from the world that we're really living in. So all of those discrepancies, I can explain them away. Just happens a little differently.
Okay. Yeah. So like even City on the Edge of Forever, when they go back, mm-hmm. that sort of has changed the timeline. So it's not ours. It's a parallel.
Well, the original timeline that they're in isn't even ours, right? So there's some similar things that happen with, you know, World War II and the Depression and all of that. But, any change or anything that happens doesn't affect us. I mean, I think personally in Star Trek, we've never actually seen our own universe, our own timeline, but something that's very similar to our own. So works for me.
Very nice. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, yeah, I like it as well. Jeez.
It's going in my head canon right now.
Oh, good. Yeah.
No. I smell something burning in my head. I don't know. We're talking about time travel here. But yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I like about this episode as well is one of the writers is Joe Manosky. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with how off the wall Joe Manosky's ideas are, but he's the guy who wrote Darmok, which is, of course, I love that episode. And it's a very unusual concept. And this is an unusual concept, too. Hey, Data's head's in San Francisco 500 years ago. What's going on with that? And he just has he wrote a number of Next Generation episodes and Voyager episodes, and a lot of them are just kind of really unusual, off the wall kind of concepts. And I just like seeing those kinds of things. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm excited also that he's going to be writing for Discovery. So we'll see what kind of odd things come out of
that. Yeah, I heard that and I was like, yay. A lot of people don't like Masks. Another one of his.
I like it.
I like it too.
I think it's fun.
I do too. And it is. It's just so off the wall. And again, one of those that you remember. You say Masks and you know exactly what it is. So, yeah.
That crap episode that Damien likes.
You're outvoted 2-1.
That's right.
Lee's got some kind of FC voter here or something like that. Or no, that's his head on the ground now.
Yeah. So he only gets 1/5 of a vote.
You know, he was actually, I'm glad you mentioned him, because he actually was the one who inserted the number 47 to his scripts as
That's right. It was because of Manosky that we get so many 47 references in TNG. Yep. and later. Have you read the background on that? It's kind of interesting.
No.
I know about the number 47 putting into his scripts, but the backstory, no, I do not. Well, so why don't you tell us?
Apparently when Manosky was in college, if I'm remembering right, it was Claremont College in Southern California. He had a professor that had this pet theory that the number 47 appears more than other any other number in the universe. So he decided to, Minosky kind of took that and decided to start inserting that into scripts to kind of make that real. And then other writers too started picking up on that, so that you get, you know, all these references through TNG and DS9 and Voyager. I think there's a few in Enterprise too. But yeah, it was this odd theory that 47 appears more than other numbers, and he just kind of made it true by inserting it in the scripts.
You have piqued my mathematical mind. That's interesting. I'd never heard that before.
You just made a lesson plan for her.
Well, actually, there's another part to it. This professor thought it was 47 and 74 that appeared more for whatever reason. I don't know, but
a palindrome.
Yeah. So that's where that comes from. So, I like Minosky because, you know, even if it's something that works, he took a chance and you know, gave it a try with something that's unusual. And, you know, oftentimes it works out and you get something you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So I really like that. And that's the case with this episode, because I think it's really unusual. Like, what other episode has, you know, a literary figure as a big player in a Star Trek episode? I can't really think of one. So I think it's just fun to do that. And for him to, you know, spout off all of these arguments and ways of seeing the world.
Yeah. And I like that, again, talking about literary figures, that Guinan is a literary figure in that time period as well. And so.
Right. And we also somewhat get a feel of why or how she knows Picard already. So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't truly explain it, but yeah.
Yeah, I really like the interplay that, you know, on the Enterprise D, Guinan's like, no, you need to go back. And then he goes back and then she doesn't remember him, you know. And so it's like, well, the first time Picard doesn't know what's going on. And then when they go back, Guinan doesn't know what's going on. So that interplay between that, I really find that interesting too.
Yeah, I love that as well, because Guinan's one of my favorite characters because she's so mysterious and wise and is often giving really great counsel, and being able to see, you know, how they first meet, at least from Guinan's perspective, is really great. And I think there's a scene toward the very end where Picard sees Guinan after the adventure and they just kind of share a look like, ah, now we know.
I know. Now how hard know. Would that be to meet up with Picard in the 24th century and have to remain quiet and not say anything until season 5, you know?
Yeah, well, and I don't know if Picard even has any idea that there was something else that was going on, because I think they, you know, from his perspective, first met in their days on the Stargazer, I think is the implication. But I don't know if he even really knew until this episode that there was more. And
right, exactly. And so for Guinan to remain quiet and not disturb the timeline in any way was pretty awesome. Be so hard to do.
Yeah.
That's a big secret to keep.
Although she does kind of push it forward on the timeline, though, because she's like, you have to go, because he doesn't want to go. He's like, why do I need to go on this away mission? But you have to go or otherwise we'll never meet. And I think you get this look from Picard like, oh boy, I sure wouldn't want that to happen. I love having you in my life, so I guess I have to go on this thing and trust you. And I love the trust that they have, because, you know, there are other episodes like yesterday's Enterprise where Picard has to be pushed, and he's like, well, I wouldn't do this for anybody else, but I'll trust you and I'll, you know, sacrifice the ship of people. So there's something really special between them that I kind of wish we would have gotten more exploration of.
Yeah, well, and because Picard trust her, so does everyone else on the crew. You know, when she comes on and Riker, is that still yesterday's Enterprise? And Riker's like, Guinan, you've never been on the bridge before. You know, and so there is that implicit trust because of Picard's trust in her that filters down to the rest of the crew. And I really like that. Even Geordi has mentioned, you know, that he trusts her as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I got nothing on that one. You guys said everything that I was already thinking. I'm like, okay, all right, I'll just sit here.
So I wanted to, if I could, talk about something else. So like in part one, when, you know, they first make this discovery of Data's head, there are all of these different scenes where people are talking to him like, doesn't this make you uncomfortable that you're going to you know, that you're going to die, that you know that this thing's going to happen to you. And he actually has a really good conversation with Geordi where Geordi's asking him about that. And I just took some notes on it. And he says he finds it really comforting because he expected to, you know, outlive the friends he has, make new friends, and just, you know, possibly live forever. But for him, there's a comforting moment because it says, you know, I'm no different from anyone else. I'm one step closer to being human. And that's just a really great moment for him because he gets this, you know, sense of peace out of it because he's wanted to be human. And this gives him one step closer if he's going to die. Now, of course, at the end of the episode, he is going to continue. So it's still open-ended like that until Amy's favorite movie. I don't know, but also I don't know. I didn't think about this beforehand, but after the end of the episode, Data is wearing a 500-year-old head for the rest of his life. So he has he has on his shoulders this reminder that there is that possibility of mortality. So I have to think that it kind of still gives him some comfort there. But I think that's just a great scene for him to talk about, you know, the possibility of living forever. I mean, it doesn't seem like he can't be at this point sad about it, but it gives him some kind of comfort to know that he's no different and there will be some kind of end at some point, because you don't really deal with what it in Nemesis as much with that anticipation or the way people feel about it. And I love the way that they deal with it in the first part here.
Yeah. I also had that on my notes to talk about that. Yeah. His quest to be human is now one step closer because of his mortality. And he knows that there will be an end. And I really did appreciate that. And a little side note, so when they find the head, there's a certain percentage of degradation. And so he's living with that degraded.
No, it's okay. Geordi used his magic instrument to fix it.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
So yeah, he got it back up to skin or something like that. Something that's a polymer that lasts forever or something like that.
Yeah, you know, it was just degraded a little bit on the outside, but it's cosmetic. You just put a new skin on, no problem.
Oh, okay. So I thought it was the circuits and stuff.
Paint
them.
Yeah. Just paint them. Yeah. You're good.
Yeah, just have a little air blower inside there, get all the dirt and dust out.
The dust, yeah. The little spray can.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so I liked sort of going on with that with Troy and Riker when they're in the turbo lift. And, you know, you really see Riker's anger and his emotion that he's upset that he's going to be losing his friend. And Troy relates it to, you know, knowing someone has a terminal illness, you know. And I like how it just real quick brings in another social commentary on how do we as a society deal with a loved one who has a terminal illness, you know. And we get to see Riker's interpretation of being upset and angry. And I was just wondering, how have you dealt with someone who's had a terminal illness? Myself, my grandmother passed away of Alzheimer's. And, you know, that's just, but she lived a good old age. And so for her passing there, it was a relief, you know, but because she had lived 93 years. And so that was good. And so we get to see, I wasn't angry, so I didn't have that relationship of what Riker was feeling. So I wanted to know what you guys have dealt with that.
Oh, well, yeah, I had a couple of things. I mean, the example that I think of, my grandfather had Alzheimer's and he was kind of, you know, slowly slipping away when I was a kid, to the point where, you know, he couldn't remember who you were, which was kind of, it was a sad situation. But this situation is different because Data seems, you know, healthy and there's no illness. I mean, I think the talking about it as like a terminal illness is actually right because there's, you know, some kind of expiration date that's coming up in the future for him. But But it's a little bit different. And I think it's interesting to see Riker's passion in this episode, because at a certain point, they have to take a big risk. And they're like, is this really worth it? And they're like, Data is the only thing that matters here. This is worth it. We have to do this. And I think it's such an interesting contrast from, you know, let's say when they first met at Encounter at Farpoint, when Riker's just amused by Data, like, oh, hello, Mr. Pinocchio, who's whistling here. He's just kind of an amusement or a curiosity. But now he's someone that's so important and so integral to the crew. And you see that in the different conversations that Data has. He's become somebody that's really important. They think of him as, you know, just as sentient and important as everybody else because of everything that's happened over the previous years. So I think it's an interesting reflection on his character and how he's been able to really connect with everybody in the 5 years before.
You know, I wonder actually, so we're able to reattach his head onto the on basically his body, and then basically he can continues on to the rest of the season or throughout season six and everything. So why not just like reactivate the head? You know what I mean? Like, so you could find out what's going on or what happened or something like that. I don't know. That's just,
oh, you mean,
but I was just thinking about that.
Oh, you mean, but like instead of reattaching it, they should have just tried to like activate the head. Like you see in, was it in Disaster where Riker's carrying around Data's head? Because he needs him to help activate the engineering console. Yeah, I mean, I guess they could have—they could have done that, or you know, who knows if they couldn't reattach.
I mean, it would have ruined the story, but yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe they could have. Data could have just been like a floating head for the rest of TNG.
Yeah, he very well could have been. That would, how interesting of a story would that be? I mean, like, put him on the console, like, what do you think, Data? And I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Or give him, like, his own little anti-grav sled that he can just kind of go around the corridors.
He could be, like, Star Trek's version of R2-D2.
Oh God!
Well, just to reel it back to what Amy was saying, that actually, up until 2 years ago, I actually lost my grandmother and grandfather. One to a stroke, my grandfather, and the other one to I can't remember what it was called. It was a cancer of some sort. I want to say it was, I can't remember what it was, but it was very sudden. But like she actually didn't know she had it until it was too late. So it was a matter of like weeks before she passed away. But before that, everyone I knew that either passed away or died was all of a sudden. And most of them were because they're veterans. Everyone that I knew that was close to me. So before that, no one died in my family since 91. So yeah. I didn't even think of Time Zero as a terminal, dealing with a terminal illness or anything like that. But like I said, 2 years ago, that was really hard, to deal with that. Especially, it's that close to the chest, my grandfather and grandmother, which I knew they were going to go sometime soon. It was a matter of time. And, you know, and they lived to their late 80s, which is fine. And I think that's pretty good. I mean, living up to your late 80s or even your early 80s, it doesn't really matter, is a pretty good run, or at least I think so. So, yeah. But yeah, it's a difficult time. I would assume that there's terminal illnesses, because you can't stop aging.
Yeah.
I mean, or at least if they do, then sign me up.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective before, Amy. And, but you do see, like, there are different reactions to it. You know, some of them are angry, others just don't want to talk about it or don't know what to think, or, you know, are in denial or have some hope that he's going to get out of it. So I think they nicely show in a series of scenes, like a range of different reactions, which is probably what would, you know, happen in real life. If someone had a terminal illness, different people will react very differently to it.
Yeah. And even Data picks up, like, everyone's treating me differently. You know, I mean, even when he walks in, Troy and Riker instantly stop talking, you know? And so, yeah, that's a little awkward. And, you know, and I love Troy's, we've grown accustomed to your, or no, what does she say? Oh, I forget. Anyway, so she talks to him and says, you know, we, and then Data's like, oh, well, I like you guys too, you know? So that was sort of cute, but you get that perspective, you know, not only of someone who's going to lose a loved one to Data's perspective of someone who's going to be gone, you know? And so you get those two perspectives there and how people deal with uncomfortable situation of death.
And of course, Data is fine with it. He's like, he's like, oh, this is a real comfort. I'm just like you guys. Why can't you see it that way? Everything's fine. We're going to let things play out. No problem. Everything's great. And everybody's like, no, we don't want to lose you. And he's like, oh, well, it's got to happen sometime. So one thing that I think is interesting is that, you know, there's also a scene where Picard holds Data from going on the away mission because he says, you know, I just, you know, want to see what I can do for you. And Data's like, you're being irrational. Cautious. Well, then I'll be irrational, you know? And I think it's an interesting contrast to the way that Picard is in, what's the episode I'm thinking about? Cause and Effect, where he's like, well, we just got to keep letting things play out as they could. We're not going to reverse or go anywhere else. But in this episode, because it's something that's personal, he's kind of making an exception that he's going to do the irrational thing and try to hold it back if he possibly can. Of course, you know, Data has to go down anyway, and it happens as it should. But Picard has this really personal connection that affects the way that he makes that decision. Whereas in other episodes, he's like, let's go on as usual. We don't know if, you know, making a change is going to make things worse. So, but he doesn't want things to go on as usual. And, you know, again, it's an example where, you know, everybody's really on the ship has really come to care for Data a lot, where he was just, you know, a curiosity of an android at the very beginning. He's become something like someone who's very well loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, right, and we see that in the season 2 Times Squared, where it's Picard, and that's that same discussion, you know, Picard 6 hours in the future. And, you know, well, why would the captain leave the Enterprise? And we need to make sure that doesn't happen. And, well, we're not going to second guess ourselves now, you know, and it's himself, you know, and still he remains true and just, we're going to do what we do. But yeah, we see that when it's Data and he does change it. It's like, I'm going to be irrational because I'm not going to lose you type thing.
Well, apparently when it's himself, he's willing to kill that self. Yeah. He wants to save Data but kill his duplicate, which, I mean,
yes.
It's just interesting these different situations, how he handles it. And you can almost see it like in his head in Times Squared. It's like, should I kill him? I really shouldn't do that, but should I kill him? Okay, I guess that's what I got to do. Whereas in this one, he just doesn't want Data to go, you know? And I think that we just see all of these ranges of emotions and ways of dealing with it that I really like and that I would have liked to see kind of more of that in Nemesis when he actually does die. So I felt like I got more of that here, and it was kind of satisfying to see that and to think about it, you know, in the future.
He doesn't die.
Well, yeah, more spoilers in the books. He comes back, but...
Yeah, exactly.
So Data has a very complicated life. He's going back and forth. So he must be really confused by the end of it, like, oh man, I just really want to be comforted by dying, but they're just not going to let me do it. Yeah.
I'm trying to get off this show. Jeez, just let me die for...
Maybe that's why, you know, Brent Spiner was playing so many versions of himself. He just wanted to make sure that he could keep going no matter what in some character or other.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention. I love in this episode that when Data is in 19th century San Francisco, that he gets into the poker game, and it's Marco Lemo, aka later Gul Dukat, who's one of the one of the poker players there. And I just love that little scene and that
Wasn't that also the beginning as well of the episode?
It,
when they were doing the poker game?
It's toward the middle of the episode, I think. It's after, you know, Data has gone on the away mission and gone back to the 19th century.
Oh, right, yeah, right, yeah. Right.
Because they're just doing it like in this hotel. And I love that, you know, Data has no money. He has no way of getting a hotel room, but he's like, oh, you have poker? I can do that. It's really, really charming. So, but I...
Yeah, there are fun bits of comedy throughout, especially with Data, you know, and when he wins the big loot and the bellhop puts out his hand expecting a tip and he shakes it, puts out his hand again. Oh, you require money.
I would give him a high five.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all those great funny moments. And, you know, because I hadn't seen Time's Arrow for a while, I was like, oh, it's that fun episode and there's a lot of funny things. But it's mostly pretty serious except for, you know, a few jokes here and there. I was surprised kind of coming back to it this time how serious it was really dealing with, you know, with the possibility of Data's death and this, you know, threat to the 19th century San Francisco and to, you know, Earth in the 24th century. There's actually a lot at stake in this episode. So I find it really interesting. I don't know if you guys know this, but Time's Arrow was originally supposed to be a one-part episode, but they decided to stretch it into two parts because Deep Space Nine had just been announced and they didn't want people to think that TNG was ending at season 5. They wanted something that would say to be continued so they'd know it would keep going even though Deep Space Nine was coming. So they kind of had to stretch things out a little bit, but it doesn't feel like it drags. I feel like there's a lot of great character moments and it just kind of, you know, keeps its momentum going and it's really enjoyable and engaging even on a rewatch. And something else that apparently happened is, so Joe Manosky, you know, had written the story for part one. And then I think the teleplay was Michael Piller. And then over that summer, he decided to move to Europe and not really be involved in Next Generation. So he gave like some notes and an outline for the second part and Jerry Taylor had to fill in the rest of it. So I think Jerry Taylor had like a pretty big contribution to the second part. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but, the reporter that's going up to Mark Twain is Alexander Enberg, who plays Torek in TNG and Vorik in Voyager, and he's Jerry Taylor's son. So I always think that's a fun little thing that he
I
got.
Did
in there.
Not know that. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Get out of my head, Justin.
What do you mean?
No. Yeah. Man, I ain't got nothing to talk about here.
He's the guest, so he gets, you know, first dibs on all the
fun
stuff.
I was excited about
this.
So I was looking up all this stuff that I thought would be fun to to talk about. But, so Richard, I know that you like this episode, but, like, what do you feel... I mean, was it any different seeing it as an adult versus as a kid? Were there, you know, things that you appreciate more or things that, you know, were unexpected and you didn't remember?
I guess as a kid, I didn't understand the relationship with Guinan and Picard. And that was my main piece of it, the difference between, because I saw it more as a story for Guinan and Picard, and obviously this is the starting point for them. And obviously we're talking about like terminal illness or something like that, or we know that Data is going to die and whatnot. But I think that's what made it a little bit more special. And then going back and rewatching the previous episodes, it makes more sense. I don't know if they intended it that way or anything like that. It definitely makes sense now. And to take it into account of Time's Arrow. But yeah, I mean, definitely this story is, I mean, it's a must story in order to explain some kind of a background between Picard and Guinan. My only issue with this episode was the Davidians, I believe that's how they pronounce it.
Yeah, the Davidians,
it.
I think. Yeah.
And that was my only beef with it during the seasons, because we really don't hear about them after that. I mean, we see it on Star Trek Online, because I know that I've read the stories and all that kind of stuff, because I play Star Trek Online. But like, and they explain it just a little bit more and add more to, and then they actually, I think it was a TOS story that, no, it was, Trouble with Tribbles? What? Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. Because they were going back to K7. Mm-hmm. That's right. So anyway, sorry. Yeah. But like, yeah, that's the only thing I don't, didn't really like about it. Well, after the fact, but I mean, it was a great story. I absolutely love it. It's great.
Yeah. I have no problem with never hearing about these Davidians before or since, because the way I think about it is, you know, it's a big galaxy. There's, you know, hundreds and thousands of star systems and species. What bothered me more actually is they introduced this thing in this episode, triolic waves, which are, you know, they're using for some kind of phase shifting to go into the past. The first time it's ever mentioned in Star Trek, never mentioned again. It would have been nice to have some mention of some impact of triolic waves, but they just kind of made it up for this episode. And I checked on Memory Alpha. You just never hear about it anywhere again. Who knows? Maybe in Discovery, they'll, you know, it'll, the whole plot will be based on triolic waves. But that's the only thing that kind of bothered me. Like, they introduced this new thing and just, you know, never touch it again. Whatever it is, triolic waves are.
Triolic waves. Yeah. I've never heard of it. I've never heard of it after this or before this.
I mean, it's literally the only reference that I could find. But, you know, what I find interesting too is, like, how do they come up with these names? How is someone writing a script and they're like, I've got this new wave. What am I going to call it? It's, you know, try something, which sounds like there's three and it's a lot of great stuff. And, oh, triolic, we've never seen that before. Because they have to make up these things that you haven't heard before, but sound kind of science-y.
Yeah, and realistic, and the creativity. Every time I watch an episode, I'm just like, oh my gosh, how do they even come up with all of this techno babble and futuristic names that we've never had? It's like, it really is astounding to me.
It's just like what Morgan Gendel was telling me a few weeks back, that, you know, they were talking about bare-end particles and, you know, scraping up barnacles off of a ship, and that makes sense. And I'm sure that's exactly what they're thinking as well. But I don't know what they're
in that case. What was that Starship Mine? The baryon sweep. Baryons are real, like subatomic particles. So sometimes they take things that are just, you know, real. But yeah, I'm always amazed they make things up, and it, you know, to my mind, it sounds like it makes sense. I'm gonna go with it. And they have this thing that looks almost like some kind of weird joystick that Geordi says is a phase discriminator that's going to get them back into the past. And, you know, they just make up these props to make it seem like there's something that they're doing with it. I think it's very inventive to get you to believe it. And most of the time I can suspend my disbelief and be like, oh, yep, that's how it's going to happen in the future, or the alternate future that all of Star Trek takes place in, as I think.
Have you reversed the polarity of the particle?
Yep. I know. That comes up so many times. Have you tried reversing the polarity? Oh, let me give that a try. I didn't think of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Always seems to be the joke, especially when I talk about technical techno babble.
Yeah, and it's especially funny when they do actually say that. Because usually it's something else, like recalibrate this or that, but they do talk about reversing the polarity sometimes. Yeah.
That's their go-to answer, just in case they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's like, have you tried rebooting your computer? It's kind of like that, right?
Yeah.
And it's then you're the go-to. And that's the IT guy be like, yes.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention, so one thing I learned from this episode is, and when I first saw it, was a new word, ophidian, which I had never heard before. Just a fancy name for a snake. So, you know, if you're playing Scrabble with me or Words with Friends and I have those letters, no matter how few points, I'm going to use it. I just love the way that Data will just, you know, give all these fancy ways of saying things, like igniting the midnight petroleum and stuff like that.
Yeah, I love that quote.
Yeah, he'll be like, oh, it looks like they have an ophidian. a snake. Yeah. Like, for the audience, they're like, what the heck is an ophidian? But I, for some reason, that's one of the things I always remember and like look for that reference to ophidian, because it's just so unusual and you just don't hear it elsewhere.
Because that's how they talk back in the 19th century, right?
Well, that's how Data all the talks. Time. I don't know if anybody...
Well, he's a Frenchman.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He is.
That's right. And I was thinking when we saw this episode, like, he says he's a Frenchman, and in, was it The Big Goodbye? He says he's from South America. I guess for somehow with his weird complexion, he could be from anywhere. I don't know.
Exactly. I was thinking that. I was like, oh, Frenchman, that's in reference. But then I'm like, no, he was from South America there. So yeah, he can just be anything he wants to be, just not American.
And somehow in the 19th century, people are like, oh yeah, look, and Marco Lemo's character, you know, tests him and speaks French, and it's like, oh, he speaks French back. He must be from France. There's no way that there's anything wrong
test.
Here. Yeah. Yeah, even though he looks like nobody they could have ever seen before, he somehow passes. So it's probably a good thing they didn't bring Worf, huh? Because that would have been hard to explain.
Exactly.
He had some kind of disease and it deformed his face.
Well, I don't know. I suppose like in the DS9 episode Trials and Tribulations, I could just give him a hat or something. I don't know. Like a big hat that goes over his forehead.
Yeah. But in the American South, I don't think they've seen Soviets wear all, or at least they stereotypes Soviets with. You know what those big ass hats
ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, they look like fur trapper
hats.
Yeah.
That would make sense. You know, Worf's adopted parents are from Russia.
There you go.
So maybe he has one just sitting around in his closet that we've never seen. He's waiting for the right time. It actually would have been really funny if he wore a hat like that when he met his parents and family. Anyway,
that's hilarious. Well, Amy, do you have anything else?
No, I was just going to say, you know, we did that recent episode on costumes and uniforms, and this is definitely a pair of episodes that really should get a shout out for their amazing costumes. I mean, Guinan's dress is gorgeous, and you know, they even make reference like when Data comes, oh, you must have woke up in your pajamas or something, and oh yeah, I can see why you're confused, let me get some, you know, clothes to match your century type thing. And Beverly in her doctor outfit, and Riker and his policeman, and he got to do some action and, you know, throw down and fist fight, and that was a fun little escape scene. I really like that. Yeah. With the horse and carriage, or was it the car?
It was a carriage. Yeah,
and so I just thought all of their uniforms or costumes, I guess, in this were very creative, and you could tell each one had their own, you know, Riker being the cop, Doctor the Crusher is her doctor, nurse, and what was Picard? Oh, the playwright practicing for his play.
Oh, for Midsummer Night's Dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun. Yeah. It actually did win an Emmy for costume design and also an Emmy for hairstyling. So they recognize that. I mean, I think they did actually like a really good job in the 19th century scenes in the second part with all of the costumes and the hair and the street scenes. And the second part, they actually filmed it on like a newly created, a New York backlot set. So they had this whole set that Paramount had just built, and they just dressed it up for the 19th century. And I think it really helps the feel of the whole thing. So yeah, they did a great job on that.
Definitely. Yeah. Any last comments?
I had one other comment. I think one of the reasons I like this one as well is because I think the scale seems pretty big in everything that's happening. And there's these scenes like, you know, you see all of a sudden, you know, Riker in this policeman's outfit and, you know, Crusher as a nurse. You have no idea how they got those outfits or how they got there. There's all of these like little bits in there where they're like, we're not even going to explain that. It just happened. So for me, it feels like there's a bigger scale and there's more to the story, more going on. And I really like that aspect of it as well. They don't feel like they have to do that. And then toward the end, when Twain goes back to the 19th century, he just kind of comes into the cave and he's like, oh, I came all the way from Market Street, which if you know San Francisco, Market Street to the Presidio is miles and miles. So it would have taken him a while to do that, but they don't feel it's necessary to, you know, have him drop in there and show him like, you know, running over a couple of miles. He just kind of appears. So in my head, it feels like there's a bigger story and there's more to be told there, which I really like.
There you go. I have no comments on the costumes really. I mean, yeah, they're great, but yeah. I mean, okay. I might as well say so. So yeah, I absolutely love actually Data's. I'm a huge sucker for ties. So
he's very well dressed.
Oh yeah, especially for a Frenchman in Middle America in the 19th century. Yeah.
Well, he's going to a literary reception. He's got to dress up for it.
You know, I wonder if he, you know, with that big brain of his, I'm sure he would have, he would know to blend in or at least know French. This is me.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about it is this is actually my favorite TNG two-parter. And favorite? Yes.
Let
me make a distinction. So okay. There's a caveat here.
I know. Please clarify.
You guys need to see the look on Amy's face.
She's like, oh my God. All right. So here's the clarification. I make a distinction between the best and my favorite. For me, the best is the one that has the best impact, the best writing and acting, and just overall, you know, the best episode. So for two-parters, absolutely, you know, Best of Both Worlds, Redemption, Gambit, a whole bunch of the two-parters are better than this one. But this is my favorite because I love watching it over and over again, and I think it's a lot of fun, and I love that they're dropped into the 19th century. So that's why it's my favorite. But I am in no way saying that it's the best TNG two-parter, because it's not. But it is my favorite.
She just gave you a thumbs up.
Like, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, but for favorite, I always consider it like which one is my go-to or I want to watch again and again, or in my rewatch, I'm like, all right, it's this episode, because I know that like Chain of Command is amazing, but I don't want to watch it all the time because it's brutal to watch, you know. But this one's always fun to watch, so that's the difference.
Yeah, I like that distinction between best and favorite. That's fabulous. I enjoy Time Zero Part 1 and Part 2. And people that I know, like my brothers, when I got my Blu-ray, they're like, let's watch Time Zero. And I'm like, you know, you're the minority in most of fandom who don't really like Time Zero. And they're like, who cares? We like it. So I, too, enjoy the episode. I think it's fun. It's definitely is something you can go to and just watch over and over. And I know I've seen it so many times, but the time loop, you know, if you think about it too much, time loops, yeah. But that aside, it is a really fun episode. Pair of episodes, I guess.
Yeah, it's for me, it's definitely a fun episode. Any episode that gets them out of the norm, being in a 19th century clothing or even a 19th century setting or any setting really outside of what the norm is outside the ship, it definitely is one of my favorites. I'm not going to go out as far and say it was my favorite, but it's right there in the top 10.
Okay.
I absolutely like anything that goes outside the norm. And this is by far one of them.
Yeah,
we get to see their range of acting, and it's brilliant. It really is.
Yes. Well, Justin, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on Earl Grey. Thank you so much. You do so much for us and are an associate producer on Patreon, so we appreciate you so very much.
Thank you. It's been great. It's been such a great time because, you know, I've always wanted to talk about these episodes and to give them some love that they haven't gotten before. So I'm glad we could do that today.
Awesome. And next time I'll definitely have more to say. Yep. Cause you destroyed me on research, dude.
I'm sorry. I just like to be prepared with, I've like half of the fun of watching it is looking up the stuff afterwards to find out how it was done and who did what and all of that. So I just really enjoy that aspect of it. So.
Well, I'm sure we will have you on as a guest again in the near future, just feeling very confident. And we love all of your comments that you make in the Babel Conference. Yeah. So you're sort of everywhere now.
Oh, thank you. I'm not quite Jeffrey Combs yet, but maybe I'll get there.
Well, talking about finding Lee's missing head, Time's Arrow isn't the only topic we've been talking about here on the network. Here's a quick look at what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Leola is a substitute for any ingredient he doesn't have.
No sugar, Leola root.
Yeah. No bananas, Leola root.
No coffee,
Leola root.
Saturday morning Trek.
Roddenberry was very involved with the first episode. And for that episode, we needed to come up with the derelict spaceship. And as a result, as the brand new guy on the crew who had spaceships and stuff in his portfolio, I got the job of coming up with that ship.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, well, and also that X-24... is really what he could have become. It's what he would have been if he had never escaped from Alkali in the first place, right? So it's not only facing who he had been, but what his whole existence would have been like had he not been able to break away in the first place.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
You can listen to every show on the network at Trek.fm with links for iTunes streaming services and a direct download link. This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPod, iPad, Kindle, Android, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/TrekFM. Thank you, Audible, for supporting Earl Grey and Trek FM. If you are a weekly listener and would like to directly help Earl Grey, please consider becoming a patron of Trek FM. At patreon.com/TrekFM, you can choose a pledge level and receive rewards. For example, $5 a month gets you into our patron zone. You get exclusive content and access to our early release of all of the shows. At the $15 a month, you get to participate in our monthly roundtable discussions. They are so much fun, and that's how I got started on the network. At $25 a month, you get associate producer credits for any podcast you choose. At this time, we would like to thank our current Patreon associate producers, Michael Huter and Justin Ozer. Thank you for supporting Earl Grey. Another way to help out the network and get cool stuff is to visit Redbubble. At redbubble.com/shop/TrekFM, you can find amazing designs for t-shirts, pillows, phone cases, and more. And with each purchase, a portion of the sales goes to Trek FM. Connect with other Trek FM listeners on our Facebook discussion group called The Babel Conference. You can search that on Facebook, B-A-B-E-L, or you can like the facebook.com/TrekFM page for show updates and other announcements. The network is also on Twitter at Trek FM. If you would like to contact Lee, Richard, or me, Amy, visit trek.fm/contact to send us a subspace message or find us on social media. So, Justin, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, if people would like to find me, they can find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. And they can also find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook.
Yeah, you do tweet a lot about DS9, I've noticed. I'm just saying.
It's because I'm doing my DS9 rewatch right now. Don't worry, TNG's coming up. I'm just going to synchronize it with the 30th anniversary.
Okay, good, good, good.
But trust me, I do love TNG a lot. I'm just in the middle of a DS9 rewatch. Yeah. Although, sorry, DS9 is my favorite, but TNG's not too far behind. But no, DS9 is my favorite.
Yeah. And Richard, what about you?
Well, everyone can get a hold of me on Facebook. I'm on the Babel Conference. I pop in here and there, cause a little trouble. And I'm also on Twitter. My handle is xransom.
And you can find me on Twitter, where I tweet Next Generation, to be clear. And that is at Miss Amy Nelson. But my favorite place is on the Babel Conference. So look for me there and the fun comments and discussions that we have there. We had quite the heated discussion just recently with Nemesis. So that's coming up. Hint, hint. So join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
Today is a good day to die.
Great joy and gratitude.